the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order. It is February 23rd. Representative Tegan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the minutes for the meeting of February 16th.
Are there any additions or corrections? Representative Eakin moves the minutes. Adoption of the minutes has printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Ferdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of February 18th.
Representative Ferdahl moves adoption of the ninth meeting, February 18th, as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you very much. The handout, first item on the agenda from your handout of the group goals and priorities that we started last week when we were establishing goals and priorities and indicators of success. And the green sheet has a compilation of the group priorities that were listed on the big sheet. The first item of business today, I would like you to go back into your group and prioritize three things from your group and submit one sheet for each group. What are the three top priorities that you would go for? And I think that would take about till about 4:45. So
I used to have the open fence.
Report. The top three priorities. Linda. Down by the microphone. Group one, Linda Groomer and
Linda Groomer, Minnesota Department of Health, representing group one. Our top three priorities were under the list for number one. As you can imagine, we thought number one's ideas were pretty good. So the top priority was prevent and restore impaired waters. The second priority is improve drinking water quality. And then the third priority is under group five, number one, to assist access to the arts for all Minnesotans.
Thank you very much. Group two, Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We, being contrarians to a certain degree, thought that there should be three, kind of, as we said before, overarching goals or process requirements that I'll mention in a minute so that I can get our top three priorities on the list. And they came from our group. Parochialism prevails. Number one in group two's our first recommendation is number three, use money for clean water legacy. Number two is 6 in our group, broaden access and opportunity to state parks and trails, including regional and local trails and parks. And three would be our fourth number, which is increased access to the arts for all of Minnesota. But we thought that our one and two, transparency, equity, and then the goal in the first group, meet the constitutional requirements, were things that we ought to keep in mind as we assess all of these requirements.
Thank you very much. Group three, Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I guess we were a little less parochial than the previous group and went into some of the other groups' listings. Our top three were in the Torkelson et al. Group, the fifth one down, a larger percentage of the public will engage in the maintenance, use, and enjoyment of our cultural and outdoor resources. For our second one, we went outside the box a little bit and did the Eakin et al. Group number one, but we didn't like the piece that said that there would be a 25-year plan, but we wanted to pull in one from our group, Visible Quick Results, and have a 2-year plan, then a 23-year plan. So we kind of amended that a little bit.
Hold it now. Let me get that one.
From the Eakin group,
yes.
Number one, have a 25-year plan. We amended that to have a 23-year plan in the year 2011, and then merged in group three, number two, Visible Quick Results, for the first couple of years while we figure out how this is going to work in the long term.
Okay, where was that one? Where was the two one?
It was in group three, number two.
I see. Visible Quick Results.
Yep.
Okay.
And then our third item was group three, number five, so we were a little parochial. Prioritize projects that create jobs and leverage non-state funding.
All right. Good floor. Mr. Nelson, or no?
I hope that
works. Nope. Nelson's there, committee members. Jeff Nelson isn't here this afternoon, so I'm Brenda Rainey from the Science Museum reporting for Group 4. And we were also a bit more equal opportunity with our choices this afternoon. Our first priority is from our group. It's number one from Group 4. Every Minnesotan will have access to all aspects in the amendment, arts education, clean water, outdoor recreation, public radio, and television signal. Our second priority is number two under group five, using existing funding systems, state agencies, and entities to distribute the funds rather than create new bureaucracies. And our third priority comes from group number three, and it's priority number five, prioritize projects that create jobs and leverage non-state money. And our reasoning behind these this order is that we felt that it stuck with the spirit of the amendment and that it would deliver visible results in short order. And it also is responsible financial decision-making that would lead to economic health and enhanced credibility of the work that the amendment is funding.
Great. Thank you so much. Group five.
Madam Chair, I'm Tom Murphy, representing Science Museum. Ms. Smith is not here this evening. Our number one priority was under our group five. Number four, to assist in stabilizing arts and cultural organizations in the context of the economic crisis. Our second priority was under groups representatives of Torkelson, Howes, Wofford, and Dan Dwight. It's actually number five down. A larger percentage of public will engage in the maintenance, use, and enjoyment of our cultural and outdoor resources. Our third priority was from group number four, the first priority. Their first list which is our third priority, which is every Minnesotan will have access to arts and cultural activities, arts education activities, clean water, outdoor recreation, including hunting and fishing, public radio and television, and public television signals.
Very good. Gripson, Morgan, Lilly, David, Erdahl, Hausman, Kahn.
Madam Chair, is it okay if I stay here?
Yes.
Thank you. We looked through the other group's work and saw a lot of things that fit into some of the choices we made last time. We still had a hard time getting away from the first one on our list, the meeting the constitutional requirements. I think it's obvious that we have to do that. I just don't think it's obvious how we do that. So I think that remains our first most important goal here. Establishing measures of accountability for all expenditures, and we took a look at Group 5's number 2, and we thought that was a good way to help us do that, using existing funding systems, state agencies, and entities to distribute the funds rather than creating new bureaucracy. We figured that it would be easier to have accountability and outcome measurements with existing agencies and existing entities. And then finally, contributing to the economic health of the state. We think that implies a geographic balance, and we think that implies creating jobs and leveraging non-state money, which other groups had mentioned as well.
Very good. Group B, Park of Ten Hogs, Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We focused on process, interesting enough, compared to some groups. And our first one is on Group 2, number 2, Doug Carnival's on the second page. We have the equity, geographic and demographic, first statewide needs assessment as needed, fund statewide priorities, measure level of success in achieving equity. Our second was on the first page under the Torkelson-Hawes, Loeffler et al. Group number 2, enhanced cooperation among stakeholders, both organized and unorganized. And our third is under the representatives Eakin, Macklin, and Genius. The last item, which is legislation for accountability by websites, Office of Legislative Auditor, and Restoration Audit.
Good.
They reported.
Group C, Eakin, Macklin, Genius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. And found that a number of the things that we had prioritized in our own group also were found in other groups. For instance, we chose as number one the 25-year plan. Although Mr. Kelleher brought up what I would consider to be a friendly amendment to include from their group the actually having visible and quick results in the first couple of years would be a good idea, because obviously it takes some time to develop those 25-year plans. So maybe doing a two-year quick and visible results first, and then 23-year plan would be a good idea. Also, the balance within each account, the Morgan, Lilly, David's, Erdahl, Hausman group also had geographic balance, and I think also Group 3 did. Yes.
Slow down a little bit. Okay, so geographic balance is your second one?
Yeah, yes. So, and we wanted that to be within each account, not necessarily across the accounts. And then the third one that we had down was the no-tails. We felt that we should be accounting for all the costs when allocating the money, and not just using it, for instance, for land acquisition and then not include the cost of restoration of the land and maintaining that land. That also needs to be included in the costs that come out of this dedicated funding.
But that doesn't mean that it can't continue on for more than 1 year.
Right, yeah, that doesn't mean it can't.
Just the total cost of the project, not just the cost of an easement today.
Right, okay. Right.
Good job. Thank you very much. Oh, new group,
Hello, Madam Chair, members. I represent a group of sort of orphans.
Orphan group.
Somewhat, we're not able to be here when you did that, and actually one of our group had to leave. It was not on the meeting since we worked this out. And we came up with our number one priority. So it's from number five, Sheila Smith's group, the number two item, using, and I should say that none of the three of us are members of any organization of a government that has an existing funding program or anything, but we think it's important to use existing programs and agencies so we don't create another bureaucracy out there, or that we use methods that would require all the potential recipients to spend a lot of resources to apply for the money. So that was our number one priority. Our number two priority was from Linda Brummer's number list, which, and we picked the second one, restore and prevent polluted waters. I guess our third member switched around prevent and restore to restore and prevent, so you've got the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And our number two, we had two number two priorities.
No. We don't have two number twos.
Well, we gave equal weight, Madam Chair, number one was clearly a number one for all of us, but the other one was provide, and this was an amalgamation of number four, Jeff Nelson's list, and the first one there, to provide more and better access to public radio and television programming. So it took pieces of the different public broadcasting chunks. So.
And how many people were in your orphan group?
There were three of us, Madam Chair.
Three people. How many were part of public broadcast?
Just two, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Equal weighting. Yes, equal weighting.
You remember what our number one priority was?
I remember what your number one. Stick with what you got.
And we all agreed that both clean water and public broadcasting were very, very important.
Uh-huh. And you don't have a number three then, right?
No, Madam Chair. We didn't want to be greedy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there an orphan group two? Okay, everybody reported out that wants to report out with equal unbiased answers, I'm sure. Well, thank you. This is good. Mr. Shepherd, one of the things that came up several times already before we're even getting into things, but it came up even when the night that we had the governor's budget presented to us, and it's come up in several people's discussions since, and so I think we should bring it out in the open and have group discussion on the topic, constitutional issue. The Constitution says we will supplement, the constitutional money should be used to supplement and not supplant. Mr. Shepherd, you have prepared a very interesting reading for us, and would you talk to us about supplementing and supplanting.
Sure, Madam Chair, members, Mark Shepherd from House Research, and the Chair referred to a memo that is in your packet. There's actually two, but the first one's on supplementing versus substituting. And I'm not, those of you who know me know that I'm not in the habit of writing 10-page memos to explain one sentence. but in this case, I really thought that it would be helpful because this language is not clear, and I thought there aren't any clear answers, and so I thought it might be helpful to provide for all of you and the people in the audience some background so that others can think about this and tell you what they think and to get some discussion going on this. Obviously, this memo is only on legal issues. It's sort of what's permissible. It doesn't have, it's not on the topic of what would be good policy or responsive directly to your constituents. It's just on legal issues. And finally, you should know that I didn't participate at all in these deliberations at any time when this bill was being considered. This wasn't one of my staffing areas until this year. So there's a lot of people in the room that have a lot more experience with this issue than I do, and they may have some thoughts as well. Madam Chair, I've
listened to a lot of tapes.
Yes. I've listened to a lot of the discussions on this topic. And my general conclusions were that before I get into a lot of the confusing and arguing things that aren't clear, is that I mean, the overall intent of this really was clear through all the discussion, that this additional revenue was intended to be additional revenue, not to replace prior funding sources, and the term supplement and substitute should be understood in their ordinary dictionary sense. I didn't come across any discussions that would indicate otherwise, that there was some special technical meaning. But within that, things really weren't clear, either on the face of the language or based on the legislative history. As I listened to some of the debates and read through this, I came to some general conclusions. First of all, I think that this non-supplantation language applies both to the legislature and to recipients of legislative appropriations. I don't think either should be supplanting. I think that the language has potential at least to be applied to all traditional sources of funding, whether those are general fund, dedicated funds, or perhaps even private funds. The big issue, which I'll talk about last, is...
Excuse me, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Shepherd, how could it be that if...
How could it be that if we're not supplanting at the state legislative level, that we could possibly supplant to the groups that the money is given to? If we're not supplanting, how could they supplant?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Shepherd,
and Representative David, I'll get into it a little bit more in a minute, but my thought was is that you could have a bill in which the legislature would give a grant to an organization that had never gotten a grant before. So the legislature would be supplementing, not substituting. But when the grant went down to the private organization, they could say, great, we've got some state money. Now we don't need to use our private money anymore, or we don't need to use the city money anymore. We don't need to use our traditional source of funding. And I'm suggesting that that's not clear from the Constitution, but I think there's a good argument that the groups, that the ultimate recipients shouldn't be substituting this money for their other sources of money any more than the legislature should be when it appropriates it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Khan.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Savage, what if you, if something is irrational or uncertain as private funding, how could you ever determine? Suppose someone's given a big contribution one year and then doesn't give it the next year. So then you use it to... Could you argue that that's the
plaintiff?
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Or Mr. Shepherd.
And Representative Khan. I don't think it's clear. I think that, you know, maybe something that would be clear is if you, if there were an organization who had paid its executive director from local funds or from private funds for years, didn't lose that source of money, but got the state money and said, oh, we'll pay our executive director with the state money now, and we'll use this other for something else. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think at least might raise some concerns or might raise some arguments.
But what if they lost the money?
And I would, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shepherd.
And Representative Khan, I'll talk about that in just a few minutes when I talk about what is a traditional source of funding. Because I think that's kind of the most difficult issue here in the whole memo, and I'll walk through some of my thinking, but I kind of came to the conclusion that to give effect to all of the intent, what I viewed to be the intent of the constitutional amendment, that one way of looking at a traditional source of funding is the level that would have been there if this new money, the new dedicated money, weren't there. So if you lost your traditional source of funding, be it private or public, then you could make an argument that using this new dedicated sales tax money would not be an illegal substitution because the traditional source wasn't there anymore.
We're going to let you continue and tell your done before we're going to interrupt anymore. And then we're going to have questions then.
Madam Chair, sure. I'll take about 5 minutes just to walk through this, 5 or 10 minutes.
That's fine.
Read the whole thing. So when, after kind of puzzling over the text of this constitutional language, I listened to a lot of the deliberations and tried to see what was in the legislative history that might lend some support to one meaning or another. And I basically concluded that while some of this is instructive, and I've tried to repeat here for you in summary form the discussions I felt were most useful, that there's really not anything conclusive here that's going to jump out one way or the other and say, aha. That's what it meant. The most direct legislative discussion that I found occurred actually on the Senate floor during the debate on the final conference report, and it was a discussion I've reproduced on the bottom of page 2 and top of 3 of the memo. It was a discussion between Senator Roebling and Senator Pogemiller, and she basically asked directly, would the programs that have always received a certain level of funding have to continue to receive those in the general fund budget? She asked again, could we do across-the-board cuts under this language? And Senator Pogemiller basically said that, the intent here was not to replace, to use the new money to replace the old, but he, I think I actually quoted him here, that this is not a perfect science. He said that this language cannot lock in a future legislature. So you got the sense from listening to this that he wasn't saying that you absolutely can't cut existing budgets if you're going to fund something. At least within some margin of error on this. And then you note toward the bottom of this exchange on the middle of page 3, Senator Hahn, who I believe voted against the bill, at least he indicated in his remarks here that he didn't favor it. He thought that that was wrong, that this was a strict, you can't reduce existing budgets provision. So there wasn't unanimity even when this question was raised directly. I note on the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4 just some other places where this was discussed, primarily in the Senate. And again, same kind of conclusions. There's nothing real definitive here. There's some, I would say, indications that people thought there was some flexibility in here in this language. And there was no direct statement that would indicate a strong, rigid, you can't cut this program at all kind of position in the legislative history. There was an interesting amendment on the House floor when this came up. It would have added language at the end of this supplement substitute sentence that would have said, nor may other operating budget items in the environment and arts budget be reduced because of the newly dedicated funds. And that was defeated 21 to 112. And you need to sort of listen to the whole context of that discussion to sort of understand what it was about. It wasn't quite as straightforward as it appears here. The next thing I did was just look at some other statutory language. I know that a number of the members here, even in prior discussions of this committee, have mentioned that they were familiar with language that governs the LCMR and the LCCMR, which is making recommendations for some of the constitutionally dedicated state lottery proceeds. And on the top of page 5 of my memo, you'll see that there had been for some time some language in the LCCMR statute, not in the Constitution, that was very close to the language that wound up being adopted by the voters in the Constitution. It says, and still says, that the trust fund can't be used as a substitute for traditional sources of funding, but must supplement the traditional sources. And so I think there's at least a reasonable argument that the legislators who were working on this bill knew about this, and therefore if this were ever to be argued in court, there would be some argument that that they would have intended the constitutional language to have similar effect to what they knew was in statute. So I tried to learn a little bit about the LCCMR practices. I did not find any written guidelines defining this supplement substitute language, nor did I find any case law. Rather, it appeared that this is something that those of you who have been on the LCCMR do consider on a case-by-case basis, and that the members and the staff of LCCMR do require entities to provide information about their past sources of funding. And they do, it's my understanding, apply this supplement substitute language to particular grants, both in evaluating proposals and then in overseeing the work plan. So the LCCMR is concerned about things, recipients' use of trust fund money to pay for things that might be considered overhead, like computers or desks, things that might have been paid for previously from some other source. And in general, it's my understanding that the LCCMR tries to assure that the trust fund money is not used to pay for general operations or overhead, unless it directly relates to a new project that's being funded from the trust fund. Obviously, the one thing that's very different about the LCCMR language is that it's statutory. And so every time the legislature writes a new bill, it sort of, in effect, is answering the question about it's writing a new law that if it were in conflict with this non-supplantation language would probably supersede it. And because it's a new statute that is more specific and later, that, of course, will not be the case with this committee and the legislature this year when you all are dealing with constitutional language. You can't override it by a bill that you write this year. I also note on the memo on page 6 that there's another law that establishes the Clean Water Legacy Account. It also has non-supplantation language. It provides that money in the account has to be used without supplanting or taking the place of any other funds which are currently available or may become available from any source, federal, state, local, or private. And so that is a little bit different than the language that was written into the Constitution. It specifically refers to the any other source, public or private. And it's not really clear what effect that has on interpretation of our constitutional provisions. I mean, you could argue that language sort of indicates that's what you all meant, that you meant no other source, public, private, or you could argue that you meant something different because you didn't use those same words. So I just point that out as something that I think if this ever goes to court and people are arguing about it, they'll mention these things, but it doesn't, again, lead to a clear conclusion. I then tried to think about the question that Representative Pays had asked earlier, you know, to whom does this restriction apply? And as I mentioned, I think it clearly applies to legislative appropriations. I think that's clear, that the people who drafted this didn't want the legislature to substitute funding for the traditional sources. But as I explained to Representative Davis, I think there's a good argument that it also applies to state agencies or non-state entities that receive grants, too. I note that the constitutional language, it's written in the passive. It says that the dedicated money under this section must supplement and may not be used as a substitute. It doesn't say who can't do it. It just says it can't be done. And so I think just on the face of it, there's some argument that nobody can use this as a substitute. I also tried to think about at what level does this analysis occur. Does it occur at an aggregate level for all environmental spending, or does it occur for each individual activity? And I thought that, again, there's room for different opinions on this, but just to me, the plain language that the dedicated money must supplement may not be used as a substitute, I think, based partly on the LCCMR experience, would apply to each recipient. So each recipient should not be using this money to substitute for traditional sources of funding. And if each recipient didn't do that, then in the aggregate, you also wouldn't be substituting or in an illegal way. I then tried, on the bottom of page 7 of the memo, I discussed a little bit to what sources of funding does the language apply. It just says traditional sources of funding without mentioning specific ones, and therefore I think there's at least a good argument that it applies to any traditional sources of funding, which could be the general fund, the game and fish fund, trust fund, potentially even bonding funds, federal funds, local government funds, or private funds. There isn't anything that limits it on the face of the amendment to a particular source of funding. But that brings up the final issue, which is what, if it applies to all sources of funding, when does a source of funding become traditional, and what is the traditional source of funding? And there I felt that, I mean, the answer could be different for different activities, and I really didn't think it was possible, based on this one sentence in the Constitution, to come up with clear standards. I sort of walked through and thought, well, what would happen if you considered the traditional source of funding as the immediate prior level of funding? Is that what was meant? So that if an agency received a $100,000 appropriation this year and the legislature reduced it to $90,000, you couldn't use the 3/8 dedicated money to make up for it. The reason I thought that might not be the best interpretation is the Constitution doesn't refer to a specific funding level for a prior year. It's different from a number of statutory maintenance of effort kind of formulas that I've cited here that really do rigorously define that you're comparing this year to last year. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the legislative history doesn't, there's nothing that really strongly suggests that that kind of analysis was intended. There was also nothing in the legislative history or in the language that suggests that you sort of do a rolling average or an average over a period of years. I mean, that might make sense, but it would be hard to figure out what you'd average. And so I, in the absence of this, of any clear constitutional language, I was just trying to think about what was the overall purpose of this amendment, and how would you interpret this language if you were a court to give effect to that overall constitutional purpose. And I come back to the fact that I thought a primary purpose was to provide additional money for certain purposes. And in some cases, the additional money might be needed because the traditional level is declining, as Representative Kahn mentioned earlier. Funding for an activity that's financed with federal funds or perhaps even game or fish licenses could be shrinking for a variety of reasons that aren't related to legislative decision making. And I didn't think it would advance the purposes of this constitutional amendment if you said, if you're losing your current source of funding, you can't get any of this source. It didn't make sense to me, and that's why I kind of backed into this notion that maybe what a traditional source of funding is what would have been there if you didn't have this new money. And so I found it helpful to try to think about it that way. Obviously, this issue comes up most clearly in this session if the legislature makes across-the-board reductions in a variety of state programs to address the budget deficit. And under my analysis of what the traditional source of funding is, I think you could make a good argument that if you're cutting everything in state government by 10%, and arguably you would have cut arts programs and environmental programs and other programs by 10%, even without this new 3/8 money, that you could do that would be constitutional. Again, I'm not suggesting that this is a good or a bad idea. I'm just trying to lay out what I think the Constitution might mean. And I note in the memo that argument would be strongest if you didn't cut these activities more than the other ones. The last issue under the traditional source of funding is sort of the notion of how many times an activity needs to have been funded to be traditional. And that, again, there's no easy answer. I think if something had been funded only once or twice, but the legislature made clear it was supposed to be an ongoing program, you could argue that that's traditional. Whereas if something had been funded multiple times, but from a source like some of the LCCMR recommendations from the Environmental Trust Fund, that is it sort of looks like a series of one-time appropriations, you could argue that that's not traditional, even if it's happened more than once. Madam Chair, I concluded at the end by trying to think about what would happen if a court found that a law had violated this new constitutional language. It's not clear if the remedy would be to prohibit spending of this new 3H dedicated money or to order the legislature to appropriate more money from the traditional source. And I at the last page of the memo, I walked through a number of things that I thought suggest that probably what's most likely to happen is that the court would be most likely to prohibit expenditure of the new money rather than ordering the legislature to appropriate more of the traditional source. Part of the reason I came to that conclusion is because in some cases it wouldn't be possible for even the legislature to appropriate more from a traditional source if it were federal, if it came from a dedicated fund, if it were private. And so it might depend on the circumstances of the case, but that's my thinking. So I should I'll conclude and try to answer questions. Okay.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Shepherd, for that. It clears up a lot. I think this is very, very helpful here, in all seriousness. And a couple of quick questions here. First of all, this doesn't really apply to federal funds. If some agency is getting some federal funds to clean up the water or something, and those go, and we come in with money from this fund, that would be supplanting because the feds aren't really in the scenario, are they?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Davis, I think in most cases that likely would not be an unconstitutional supplantation, because if the federal money disappeared under the way I was thinking, then your traditional source is gone and you would not be substituting for a traditional source of money if you use the 3/8 money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Mr. Shepherd, as far as a little more on the remedies here, I mean, if we violate something and we lose in court, I mean, what are we going to do, take our birthday away or what?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Davis, that's where I thought that it could depend on the facts of whatever the case is. I thought that, you know, if you read this, you know, the Constitution says that the dedicated money under this section must supplement traditional sources, may not be used as a substitute. It focuses on the money dedicated under this section. So I think it might be natural for a court to say you can't spend the money the way that you appropriated it in this bill, because the way that you, the legislature and the governor, have proposed to spend it would constitute, in our opinion, an illegal substitution. So therefore, you can't spend that money. We're not going to allow you to spend that money in that way. It's not always clear that would be the result. The plaintiff, it would depend on who brought the lawsuit and what remedy they were asking for. They might bring a lawsuit asking the court to order the legislature or to order the restoration of the old general fund spending level that had been cut. So I think it's going to depend on who brings the lawsuit and probably the facts of it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepherd, and to all the roadies and groupies out there, I would just say I'm getting hundreds and hundreds of emails and phone calls and letters saying that we're trying to raid the 3/8 money and put in the general fund. I'm not sure where they're getting this information, but if you just back off a little bit, because we really don't know what we're doing here yet.
It's a blind raid.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepherd. You raised a lot of questions as well. Just specifically on a few things, and maybe you've already addressed it, but I want to make sure that I've got it right. Okay, if everything is cut 10%, let's say to one program it's cut 10%, and we restore that 10%, are we supplanting or supplementing?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, that is sort of the most profound question, and I don't pretend that I have a definitive answer. My thought, my best answer would be that what has happened there is that if you cut everything 10%, the traditional source of funding is now $90, not $100. and therefore that it would not be illegal to use some of the 3/8 money to pay for that activity, because the traditional source of money is now less than it was. But I don't, in all of this, I'm not asserting that all this is correct. I'm trying to lay out some thinking so that others can weigh in on this.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Thank you. And I appreciate that you're just trying to give us some ideas here. If something is cut more, if something is cut 50% and others are cut 10%, then when we restore, I mean, is that different than the 10%?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Shepherd.
And Representative Hurdle. I think it is. I think the more that you, I mean, you have a much stronger argument that what you're doing is constitutional if you're treating these activities the same as all other activities, and their relationship, you know, the percent of a state budget that's devoted to arts or environment has remained equal. It's just that the whole budget has shrunk. To me, that's a stronger argument for legality than if you cut something by 50%.
I just have one more after this. So, if something is cut 50%, or let's say something's eliminated, and we restore it when everything else is being cut 10%, are we supplanting or supplementing?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, Representative Hurdle, I think there'd be a strong argument that you are supplanting, that you are not supplementing, but that I think that would present a strong argument that you violated the Constitution.
Just one more. Considering bonding, you know, there are certain projects that this committee could look at that could be bonded for by the Capital Investment Committee. If we fund projects here that are bondable by capital investment, is that supplementing or supplanting?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, Representative Hurdle, I think it goes back to what's the traditional source of funding. If something's never been funded in the bonding committee, then I don't think it would be considered an illegal substitution if you were to fund it here. If there's been a regular bonding program year after year after year for a certain activity, and you cut that and appropriated money from the 3/8 dedicated sales tax, then I think there's a stronger argument that now you're substituting. But it would have to be something that had become traditional in the bonding world.
Right. I'm done.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question sort of transitions back to your first part of the meeting. Every morning when I read the sports pages, I am reading about another group out there. Now, I wasn't on any of the committees last year that established that group, and so I confess I don't really know why we did, but for some reason we have a group that's working out there on one portion of this funding, but not on others. But I read every morning about this group that's really doing its work just as we are. And I am wondering how that fits in with the work we're doing here at the process you have been taking us through.
Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, members, the statute that created the group to which Representative Houseman is referring to, the Third Outdoor Heritage Council, created that council as an advisory council, and therefore they will make recommendations this year. The recommendations will come by April 1. After this year, they'll come by January 15th, for as long as that statute is persistent law. The constitutional language states that decisions shall be made by appropriation. Therefore, the legislature and the governor's signature are the acts by which expenditures are made. So just as many advisory groups are created by statute, this is an advisory group to provide this committee, this body, this legislature, their best advice, which you may or may not use on a case-by-case basis.
And Representative Houseman, our first report that we got from House Research, Mr. McCormick,
what dealt with that or talked about that and is available from Mr. Kent for anyone that did not get that. Was it the first introduction that we got, I don't know, several weeks ago on that issue. And that was, the law was enacted as part of the game in 50, not as part of the constitutional amendment. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on that point, I think there probably is some extensive legislative intent discussions on the Heritage Council to we ask those questions. That was the statute rather than the constitutional amendment. My question goes to Mr. Shepherd on what do we do now, kind of, and what can we do now? If we, the remedies you prescribe are ones that would be ordered by the court. What if the legislature, with a signature of the governor, in this session did pass a definition of traditional source of funding? What if we went and said that this is what we mean, even though it's after the fact? Does that have any bearing at all in terms of court decision-making if the legislature acts on defining that or defining other items related to the fund?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, I think that such a statute could have a lot of effect because, as I've indicated, there may be a fair amount of room within the constitutional boundaries to define what is a traditional source of funding. So as long as you were sort of within those boundaries, I think that statute would then have effect. It could not, I mean, it would not be binding on a court. If you said that something, that, you know, whatever the legislature says, 1 year is our new tradition, and that's what the traditional source of funding is, and the court would be bound by that. They would interpret the Constitution according to their own views of it.
Mr. Hans?
But would they, if the people's representatives and their governor did vote on what this is what we mean, would that be taken into account, or is it really a pointless exercise on our part?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, my sense is that would not be something that the court, if the legislature this year defined a traditional source of funding, it's not likely to be something that a court would give a lot of weight to in deciding what the Constitution meant, because it's a new group of people. It's not the group that passed the law that the voters eventually approved.
Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Shepherd. So back to the bonding question, because with bonding we have one-time projects, we have a fluctuation of every other year usually, but then a small bonding year. So traditional sources, and we have appropriations where we had a bonding bill in 2008, but maybe that was changed or a project was canceled even. So is it the act of passing the law that would be looked at in terms of what the traditional source is, or when we look at non-bonding revenue, we had a budget that we adopted in 07, we changed it in 08, and then there were unallotments in the fall of 08, and we're still in that fiscal year. So would it be what was in effect on November 4th, 2008, or would it be what the reality was on July 1st when the funds start, 2009 when the funds start being collected?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, I'll answer those in reverse order. First of all, on the unallotted money, I think that would fit into my analysis if you have a traditional source of funding that's now lower than it used to be. And so if you had, you know, a history over through the 90s and the early part of this decade of funding something at $100, and most recently it's been funded at 90, whether through unallotment or legislative decisions, then I think you'd have a good argument that the traditional level is 90. On the bonding, I think it's a slightly different issue, and I think the issue is what constitutes a tradition. If something is a one-time item of funding, as many bonding items tend to be, I think you'd at least have a good argument that that is not a traditional source of funding. That was something we did once, and that was done. And that if you looked at, if the voters had not approved the 3/8 dedicated funding, that you wouldn't have done it again. And so I think it can vary, I think, on the facts of each case, but I think you'd have a good argument, at least, that just a one-time bonding does not make something traditional.
Representative
Perkelson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepherd, thank you for your analysis, and I think this question surrounding this issue is one of the critical questions that we do need to answer here, and it's certainly not going to be an easy one to answer. We've covered much of it already, but what I've tried to imagine is what this is going to look like as we move forward in this process 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, and it brings up a whole other set of questions. You know, say that going back to your $100 example, we cut, something gets cut from 100 to 90 for a couple of years, and then the legislature sees fit to restore that back to the 100. How do we relate to that through this constitutional amendment? And I have another question after that.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I did note in one of the detailed parts of the memo that I think the traditional source of funding analysis could be applied to a case. Suppose that 4 years from now the economy's turned around and the legislature comes in and boosts everything 5%, everything in state government. Now I think you could argue that the new traditional source of funding for the arts and environment activities should be 105, not 100, and that you shouldn't substitute between that 100 and 105. So I think that's not exactly what you were suggesting, but I think the traditional level of funding could change over time, as you were saying, depending on different appropriation patterns of the legislature, depending what was available from dedicated funding sources. I guess most clearly, if you had a game or fish fund in which a license revenue is the source of funding traditionally, and all of a sudden there was a big spike in license fees, I think you can make a pretty good argument that if you had $110 coming in 1 year instead of $100, that the legislature should supplement the $110.
Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Shepherd. Then, you know, the next question that comes to my mind is how does inflation relate to all this? I think we're going to, sometime in the next 25 years, we're going to experience some serious inflation. And how does that then, if we establish these traditional levels, however we're going to do that, I have no idea, but if we do, and then we do experience, you know, over 25 years, inflation can play a major role in this. And so are we setting a dollar amount, or are we setting a value amount when we set these traditional levels of funding?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, again, I think those are all, you know, good questions and ones that I don't have a great answer to necessarily. I do think, I mean, it's instructive to look, if you look at some other, maintenance of effort requirements for libraries and some of the human services programs, you see these really complex formulas that do get into inflation and last year, and none of that is here. So I think, I mean, the legislature arguably would have some flexibility in deciding that it's not tightened down that tight in the Constitution, and I think what you all felt is good policy, you could probably enact and hope for the best on some of the constitutional part of it. I don't think there's a clear answer.
Thank you. Just one final remark. I really, thank you, Madam Chair. I really don't think the voters of Minnesota had complex formulas in mind when they voted for this constitutional amendment.
That's it. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair and members, I want to talk a little bit about the bonding. In state law, there's a provision, even though a program may have been bonded several times or a couple of times, if those bonds aren't sold, there's a provision for them automatically to cancel. So does that mean that, in effect, the legislature, before this amendment was passed, said that, in effect, this is strictly one-time money? Does that establish the cause that it's one-time money, that it's not ongoing?
Mr.
Or
help
establish that? Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, I think that's a good argument, yes. And I think the whole nature of bonding projects and the fact that it's not traditionally used, you know, in many cases it absolutely is one time, you've done the project, you're done. The fact that projects can be canceled if they're not done, I think all those things would help make the case that the bonding money is one time in nature. So would other statutes that, for example, and I'm not familiar with the statutes offhand governing LCCMR, but to the extent that they indicate that these are to be used for sort of pushing the boundaries and a new way, not for ongoing agency operations. If you had a statute like that, I think that would help make the argument that those aren't to be considered traditional sources of funding.
One additional thing that, and we've experienced this a couple of times, or at least one time in my legislative career a couple of years ago, and that is the government shutdown. In effect, with the legislative process of having to appropriate money, there's not very many things that are ongoing, that are open and standing appropriations. Education is one, taxes is one. Everything else, I think, is suspect. If the legislature doesn't appropriate, I know the courts have stepped in and said these are essential things to go on, but they have allowed the closing of parks because we didn't appropriate the money. So with the other than those couple of things I can identify, would it not be the case that there's not tradition in anything, that it is indeed the legislative prerogative to if we don't do anything, to have zero? Because the Constitution really says our budget is zero until we pass the budget.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chairman, Representative Solberg, I do agree with that, and I think it is, I mean, it is possible that the legislature could decide to abolish an entire program that had existed since statehood.
Mm-hmm.
You could decide that program is no longer needed and fund it at zero. I don't think this amendment changes that at all. What this might change is if, having abolished it and said you're not going to fund it from the general fund or the Game and Fish Fund, can you then backfill it with the 3/8 money? And that's where I think you'd have the issue isn't whether you can abolish the program, it's whether you can come back and fund it with the new dedicated money.
So, Madam Chair, it is the definition of tradition as opposed to the definition of our legislative responsibility to fund things. Because, in my opinion, tradition of the Constitution is everything is zero until we make a determination.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'd like to give an example from the previous LCMR victory where I think we had a clear example of the planting instead of supplemental. And I actually was involved in trying to go to court to stop this, and it stopped mainly because the person I was working with was Dallas Sands, who died. So, and what we would have had to use in order to do it would have been the Senate budget and the proposal for doing it. And the specific examples I'll give was after the Environmental Trust, LCMR was originally funded by a small percentage of the cigarette tax. And it was also in the Environmental Trust Fund, also by statute, there was a chunk of money, I think it was the unclaimed prize money, not the tax money, and there was that was by statute, was then divided clearly between the Environmental Trust Fund and the General Fund. At one of the budgets, the 2003 budget crisis, I would guess, the cigarette tax money was totally put into the General Fund, and the unclaimed prize money was totally put into the General Fund. I argue with you that those were very, very clear cases of supplanting instead of supplementing. And the remedy I think we were looking at was really to restore the cigarette tax. Maybe, you know, since we never got to court, I don't know what it would have been, but at least to restore those two in future budgets to not have it happen again, which is what we were looking at. But it didn't happen, and, you know, I don't know if that's a question to be raised again, but that was, but since the supplanting, the supplement and not supplant language is statutory language, you could say that you really changed it when you passed the new appropriation and you changed the, and you allowed those things to happen. Anyway, my thought was that you had to make the court case while it was happening right away. So I didn't, you know, didn't pursue it. Plaintiff wasn't around anymore. I didn't know where else to go. But I think that's a specific example. So though we didn't go to, you could clearly, this was the only source of funding for that. It had been there for 30 years, and you eliminated it and because of the existence of the Environmental Trust Fund. But that difference, as Mr. Shepherd pointed out, was that that was statutory and not constitutional. So, I don't know if anything like that is likely to happen, but I think that's a clear example where you could have made that argument very clearly on the constitution. Yes?
Representative Hodge.
Thank you very much. In some of my past history, it's easy to judge this if you're in a stable budget or in a growing budget, because they would be telling you if you've previously been doing it, you can't take this money and do it with that, with the new money. I'm not too sure how all that works if there's massive cuts and you can no longer do that program. I think that might start changing case history, because I don't think this has been looked at that much with tremendous cuts coming and then trying to backfill to maintain a program that could not be maintained in the traditional way. I don't see a problem at all with, or have I ever had a problem with this for capital outlays or new projects or new programs. I don't see how it's pretty hard to be in violation for a new capital outlay, a new project, a new purchase, or a new program. And if you're really getting massive cuts, I think we really do have to decipher whether it is a supplement or a substitute, because it really isn't a substitute if it can't be done in any other manner. What is being substituted? You know, it's easy to define substitute if it could be done in some other manner. But if you can't do it, the word substitute isn't going to fit into that language very well. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Mr. Shepherd, who always helps us think through complicated issues from a number of perspectives. The capital bonding item, though, still, in terms of how you define traditional funding, I can see where a specific project is a one-time commitment, but I'm wondering whether or not you might be able to, or it could be argued in the court, that categories could be grouped, and so that if we have traditionally spent X percent or X dollar amount in our bonding bills for wastewater treatments or parks and trails or you know, preservation of historic sites or any of the potential groups of expenditures here, could you imagine that being argued, that a traditional source of those capital investments has been established by the collective history of bonding by type, not by specific project, but by type of project? Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, yes, I think I can imagine that being argued. I mean, I think that's... No. That's a possible argument, and I think that's kind of a difficult issue that might turn on the facts of a particular case.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of
quick things, quick observations. First of all, since the Greenleaf has been funded twice by capital investment, I think it, that would be a traditional source. But more seriously here, a lot of questions have been raised. We're making some assumptions about tradition and supplanting and supplementing and bondable projects, and at some point fairly soon we have to go forward on these things. And just a question, Madam Chair, and I know that this is part of the process of getting there, but when do you think we will be able to reach those conclusions and go forward on some of these items?
I'm hoping in March.
Okay.
Representative Colbert.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I want to keep one thing in mind, that we can discuss what the court may do, but we should probably have the words of tradition and so forth in mind. But we are the legislature, and the court is the court, and we do not interpret the legality of our actions. The court determines the legality of the actions only if and when someone challenges our actions. So I know we should be holding the Constitution and try to interpret them, but the final interpretation is always done after the fact, when someone feels that they're aggrieved by our actions. So in effect, we're free to do what we want, I suppose, until the court slaps our hands. That doesn't mean we should, but I said we're free.
Well, we have to go forward. So, is there anyone in the audience that wants to ask a question or state their definition of supplant or supplement? Okay. No. Yes. Opportunity arises now. There's one more opportunity. If anyone wants to submit a differing opinion from what Mr. Shepherd compiled for us. And wants us to think of supplement and suppliant in a different way. Or has a strong opinion of what suppliant and supplement is. Please do that within the next 4 days and submit it to Mr. Chen. Any member that wants to define in terms that you want us to follow, the invitation is the same for you. In the next 4 days, submit it in writing, and we will publish and discuss it again. Mr. Shepherd has also talked about some of the other terminology that was in the Constitution that we also have to consider in relation to the four funds. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, I'll just take like 1 minute on this, because this second memo really is more background and less conclusions. I am listening to some of these tapes trying to get some guidance as to what is culture and what is art and other questions like that. And I've basically reproduced here just some background, some summaries of what some of the chief authors and others said about that, without really coming to any definitive conclusions. So the one thing I did notice is that you do, in the language of the Constitution, see in some cases there's words that are a bit limiting, like preserve, protect, and enhance. In other cases, the money is just for arts education, arts access. So it's a little bit different phrasing. It's to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. I don't really know what to make of all those. I don't feel like I have anything more to say than anybody else would. But just for your background, that the memo sort of summarizes what I found by listening to some of the committee tapes. I just on the other memo, Madam Chair, too, I'd note that I stated on the very front page of the memo that this subject of supplantation really is unclear, and I viewed this memo as my starting point, and recognizing that others may have information or analysis that would lead me to change my thoughts. So I'd very much welcome hearing from people on this, because I think there's a lot of probably a good thoughts out there.
And in addition, we do have to come to some kind of a conclusion or understanding of what we're going to be doing and what we're going to be allocating or appropriating for. Representative Collins.
Is there anything you would do to wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitats of fish, game, and wildlife that isn't covered by Restore, Protect, and Enhance, except destroy? Is there any activity that's not covered by those three words?
I
ignore. No.
I don't know. Please read through this, both of these analysis from Mr. Shepherd, and if there's any additional questions, please put them down and we will have another time to discuss them in the future. The other green sheets that you were given today on individual goals, process goals, the members and tally sheets, we will deal with that at the next meeting. And so, hang on to them. At the next meeting on Monday. And the next meeting on Monday may go longer than this meeting. This meeting is adjourned.